before doing himself in an amazing film. But I just want to remind people, December 16th through the 22nd at Clinton Street, the Hunter Thompson funeral film. Then after that, across Aaron's Magic Village, God Distributes Wiseness and Foolishness Through a Newly Created World. And then December 30th, Breakfast at Tiffany's for Old-Timers.
Well, Seth Sonstein has owned the Clinton Street Theater for a few years now, maybe three or four. Took it over from Dennis Nyback, a truly strange and wonderful man. Seth is pretty strange and wonderful himself. He is, when you see those bumper stickers that say, Keep Portland Weird, Seth Sonstein is doing more than his part to help keep Portland weird. Just all you have to do is look at the schedule at the Clinton. And the other one, of course, is the Hollywood.
Thank you.
Richard Beer is doing a spectacular job at the Hollywood, picking up films that slip through the cracks, just like Tom does at Cinema 21, that would get no or very, very limited commercial exposure in a film town like Portland. The Hollywood goes out of its way to find films that are interesting from other cultures, from other countries. It's truly an amazing job that these three institutions are doing. And there's always the Northwest Film Center as
well. I saw a film there a week or so ago at the Hollywood Theater about suicide bombers.
Paradise Now?
Paradise Now. What an amazing film.
Yeah,
no whitewashing, just a real hard look at what it's like to grow up in one of these Palestinian camps, no hope, suicide bombers sort of, or this sort of old cadre of people probably linked to Arafat come walking down the trail and take these disaffected young men and attach religion to it, and it's an unbelievable story.
Yeah, any Israeli film, for example, that you will see at the Hollywood always has this ambivalence about Israel's role in the world and role vis-a-vis the Palestinians.
Yeah, everything that I've ever seen at that theater, as I feel the same way about Cinema 21 and Clinton Street, they're never amiss.
No, that's correct.
Everything I see is worth going for.
And they still play Rocky Horror at the Clinton.
There are a couple of big films in town that I just wanted to mention, and I should let people know you are Eddie Goldberg. You do the film show here at KABU every second and fourth Friday at 9 a.m.
Wednesday. Yeah, I'm here on Friday.
And you're here with me on third Friday. There are a couple of films that I think are worth mentioning, and I haven't seen Sirianni yet, but the George Clooney film, I think, is probably worth checking.
It is, but I'll tell you, it's primarily for the work of the actors in the film and for a little glimpses into the life of what goes on there. For anybody who follows KABU, who follows the events of the world in the Middle East, there's nothing surprising about what you're going to see. The betrayals, the effect that the major oil companies have on the politics of the Middle East, the effect that the politics of the Middle East have on the oil companies, and the role of the CIA and the American government in all of this. George Clooney plays a betrayed CIA agent who's been working for his country to the way he sees the right for a long, long time, and they hang him out to dry. It's an amazing movie.
Does that sound like Valerie Plame?
If this had happened to Valerie Plame, the poor thing would be dead.
Also, Brokeback Mountain, which David Walker at the Willie Week really likes.
Yeah, I was not able to see the screening on this. I'm going to attempt to see it commercially before our next show in the end of December. This is taken from a short story by E. Annie Proulx, and everybody I have talked to said this movie is magnificent.
David describes it as a major change in the direction of the culture of filmmaking about gays.
Well, I'm sure that's true. Dawn Taylor, who works with us on Movie Talk, saw the film and gave it an A+. She said it's one of the best films she's ever seen.
Wow. And then a new one coming out with Ralph Fiennes, The White Countess. Have you heard about that one yet?
I haven't seen it yet. That's not been screened.
Yeah, it's coming soon. Okay, so those are the ones that I had at the top of my contemporary list.
Anything else? Yeah, King Kong. why do we need another remake of King Kong? Because this is one of the best movies of the year. It's stunning. It's too long. I will readily agree to that. But it's 3 hours long, and after 3 hours, I did not feel as though I had been sitting in my seat for 3 hours. So that says something for it. This is a film where the love story is the thing that's really accentuated. I mean, with all the great special effects and Kong fighting off three T-Rexes and all that stuff, what you get, what it finally comes down to, is the love story between the Naomi Watts character, Ann Darrow, and a 25-foot gorilla. And the last scene on top of the Empire State Building is so tender and gorgeous and heartbreaking. It's really a wonderful film.
Mm-hmm.
The other movie called, I may have talked about this before, Kiss Kiss Bang Bang, which is a wonderful film noir, one of the funniest, darkest movies of the year. I think it's, if not the best film of the year, certainly in the top three. What else is out there? The Sarah Silverman film that we talked about.
Mm-hmm.
You might be offended by this movie. I won't say that you won't be offended, but I think you need to see it anyway.
I think you do, too, and I think you need to sit through it. And a lot of the people criticized the interludes of dancing and singing. But you know what? It's a woman's film, first of all, so I'm going to defend it on that ground. It's a woman's sensibility and aesthetic. And those little vignettes that are sung in along with the comedy routine are, to me, the part that drives home the Jewish-American princess motif. Because you've got all this kind of fluffy stuff that's in women's heads of a certain kind, not all women, but of a certain kind. And and then when she does her 911 and her AIDS and her Holocaust jokes, that stuff comes into context because you're seeing it through the eyes of a fluffhead who then is being critiqued by Sarah Silverman. So I think it works for me, but I can see why male reviewers, and I'm not picking on you, might not get it.
No.
It's a woman's aesthetic, I really think so. And I want to encourage women to remember that and make your own judgments about films because a lot of the reviewing is still done by men. Take the risk, if you're a gal, and get out there and see them and draw your own conclusions. And Eddie, the shoe doesn't fit you, so don't worry about it.
No, I'm not worried about it at all. For example, the movies that are generally called chick flicks, they seem to follow a formula, and once you've seen that formula, you're just looking at different people plugged into it. And they do it because people come to see these films. So just let's all remember that movies are one of the most manipulative forms of the arts that exist. They can show images and make noises that will move you, your heart and your mind in any direction they want. One more comparison to Lenny Bruce with Sarah Silverman. The thing about Lenny Bruce that always amazed me is the compassion he had for the people he was satirizing. Where when he adopted a persona of a racist or of whatever it was, a religious fanatic, he humanized it to the extent that he wanted you to know that the difference between you and these people is tiny. Mm-hmm. That you could be them and they could be you. If something had happened in your past that was slightly different. And Sarah Silverman understands that. And I think that's the real reason she's the major heir to Lenny Bruce, is that she understands the humanity of the people she's satirizing.
And the film is Jesus is Magic.
Jesus is Magic. Great
title.
So we
shouldn't forget that. Yeah. Eddie, we don't have a whole lot for culture and politics. Is that what I meant to say?
Like Paz and Jop in the Village Voice?
But I'm getting ready to ask a Bush question, so
sure.
That's probably why I flipped it around. Eddie, here's my question. Is it true that oceans can't protect us anymore?
That's what they say. Huh? When I was in high school, in the Triassic era, our teachers would say one of the reasons that we've never been invaded is because we have a major ocean on each side and friendly countries to our north and south. Well, we still have friendly countries more or less to our north and south, but oceans don't stop nothing. It won't stop the bird flu if that ever gets here, and it certainly won't stop people from hijacking airplanes.
Mm-hmm.
So, yes, we should have been thinking about this a long, long time ago. All administrations for the past 30 years, Republican or Democrat, should have done more thinking about this, but our actions in the world are what creating this group of enemies that we have.
Mm-hmm.
If we had been smarter about what we did in the Third World, if we had been more compassionate about what we've done in the Middle East, a lot of this would be off our necks.
Mm-hmm. Another big question that's been percolating through the media, but not the major media, is Jack Abramoff.
Oh, man.
And all of the ties that he has, which are certainly now starting to affect Ohio politics. Ralph Reed, the Christian Coalition, wants to run for lieutenant governor of Georgia. The Latest Nation ran a piece. Dave Emery's been doing a lot of work, which I haven't played yet, with Daniel Hopsicker. There's a grand jury investigation in Florida. This guy's linked to DeLay in a way in which you begin to see how DeLay filtered money to specific candidates and gerrymandered districts so that he could load up the Congress with Republicans.
Absolutely.
Particularly in the House, and it worked.
Yes.
And that's part of the problem we're having right now. So when you hear the word Abramoff, you know that you're sitting at the top of a pyramid of an incredible amount of, malfeasance?
Yeah, he's the pivot man in that circle, jerk. There's no doubt about it. Abramoff is a dirty lobbyist. And when you say lobbyist, already you're talking about a class of people that are slightly shady. So when you say a dirty lobbyist, you're talking about pond scum, basically. And this guy, he's a crook, he's a manipulator, he's a power broker, he's a influence salesman, and he's as dirty as they come, and Tom DeLay is his alter ego, his Siamese twin. This is going to affect a lot of people in both the House and the Senate because they all took money either from Abramoff or from DeLay or from some mythical corporation or PAC that they put together to distribute money. And this is going to be a big stinker. And I say this because there's Democrats involved in this, too. Whoever this takes down, good. We don't need them in our right. political system.
Another big story, Karl Rove is apparently in a lot more trouble than we're hearing about. One of his a secretarial assistant, administrative assistant types, a woman named Susan Ralston, has been called back to the grand jury.
Right.
He told her not to log phone calls regarding Val Plame, and so that's continuing to unravel. And it, again, reminds me that a lot of what's going on publicly from the White House is on some level an attempt to create some distraction from this.
Without question. And remember, the cover-up is always worse than the crime.
Right.
In this case, the crime was pretty bad. It functions as treason mm-hmm. in a time of war. Well, let's mm-hmm. not forget that. But the other thing is, in their attempts to cover it up, and in their attempts to, what is it that magicians do? They detract your attention, or distract your attention in one thing while they're mm-hmm. doing something with the other hand. That's what
sleight
they're doing
hand,
now.
Yeah.
Sleight of hand, yeah. It's This whole thing is going to blow up fairly soon because this Fitzgerald guy is a decent, hardworking, and he's a prosecutor with a lot of integrity, and he's their worst nightmare.
Mm-hmm. Speaking of sleight of hand, John McCain was on Meet the Press with Tim Russert a week or so ago,
yeah.
where they trashed Murtha with faint praise by saying, well, he's an old man, he's very emotional, he goes to the funerals of all the soldiers who have died, who are, by the way, being brought in as freight on commercial airlines now. Another mm-hmm. hideous story about what about the morale of the soldiers? What are these guys doing to these soldiers when they bring their dead bodies back in commercial planes as freight? Jesus. No flags, no ceremony, nothing. But McCain, who was opposed to the torture act, was being challenged by Mr. Cheney and Mr. Rumsfeld,
mm-hmm.
and all of a sudden, Mr. Bush starts to agree with John McCain. Now, Randy Rhodes has a theory about that. I just wondered if you had a theory about it, and then we'll talk about Randy's theory. Why is Bush suddenly switching gears from no torture to, oh, sure, John?
Well, I think it's so he can take the moral high ground while Cheney and Rumsfeld continue to do the dirty work under the surface.
That's a good one.
It's strictly, again, distracting your attention while the real work is going on.
Mm-hmm.
They're trying to recast Bush now as involved and taking care of business instead of the distracted dimwit that he seemed to be mm-hmm. after Katrina and with all the stuff that's been going on in the last few weeks, that the Rove thing has been distracting them in the White House. So they're giving him the high ground while everybody else goes out and does the dirty work.
Mm-hmm.
John McCain, my feelings about John McCain have changed a lot in the last couple of years because I think in many ways he's a tool of the Republican Party, and in many ways the courage that he has displayed in other areas of his life have not been displayed in his political life. But he did manage to get them to consider the anti-torture bill.
Yeah, he may be a shill. Randy's theory is that he's probably going to be the number one guy for 2008.
I think that's without question.
And that's what part of this is about.
Cheney can't run.
Right.
And Cheney's negatives are in the stratosphere, and he's had four heart attacks. So.
And Bush is kind of handing off with the idea that McCain will continue an awful lot of what this administration wants.
Yeah, and I think that's the reason that McCain has been kissing the butt of the Republican hierarchy is so that he can be considered. I mean, he's been considered a maverick in his party for so long. Now he's scrambling for their love and attention.
Mm-hmm.
Not going to get mine.
Never going to get mine. Never did, never will.
Are you going to mention Hillary Clinton?
Well, sure, go ahead.
Hillary Clinton. What do you think about Hillary Clinton? Well, I don't know. She said she supported the war, but I'm willing to give her that because everybody has reasons for supporting the war on some level
false
or another.
False intelligence.
Whatever it is. But now she's the co-sponsor of an anti-flag-burning law. So where is Hillary Clinton going? You know, I would have to say that I don't care because I'm not going to follow her there.
I have a thought about that, and that is when you're running for national level elections, you have to appeal to a constituency that's much different from local politics. I still think that Hillary Clinton probably has her head on straight enough. Has Bill Clinton behind her, certainly, or next to her.
I was never very fond of him.
Somewhere
either,
around. Yeah. Well, we have a lot of differences on that one, but I still think that they would be much better for the country than the alternatives that I've seen. And I'm not saying yes or no, but I'm going to give her some grace period because I think she's struggling to survive in this hideous Republican Congress with all these thugs and trying to do some, you know, networking in order not to be smeared in the larger political arena. That's just the way I'm thinking about it. But let's go on to a question that I really wanted to have you talk about. Wolf Blitzer, who's been chastised by Jon Stewart on Comedy Central, has sort of tightened up his act a little bit. He interviewed a guy named Josh Bolton, who's the budget director, on the 5th of December. And, of course, Bolton was going on and on praising the tax cuts, the Bush tax cuts, for improving the economy and improving jobs, neither of which are really improving.
Mm-hmm.
But he was just, you know, taking the party line. And at one point, Blitzer just kind of cut in and said, how much is the war in Iraq costing the taxpayers in this country? And the guy literally fumbled. He never saw it coming. And I was proud of Wolf, and I applauded with my cat.
Mm-hmm. You clapped your cat?
Well, I told the cat. Well, that's very good. I mean, I was very excited. And what the guy finally concluded after fumbling and hedging was that it is costing taxpayers right now $6 billion a month.
Yes.
And he said the reason that's high is because we're buying so much that the soldiers need, mm-hmm. which, of course, is a lie because we know they're dying because they don't have armor.
Yeah, it's because we're giving it to Halliburton and their friends.
Right. So the next thing that emerged was the issue of the trade deficit. We currently have a $200 billion trade deficit with China, which means they export $200 billion more to us than we to them, and that means that they own about 20 to 30% of our economy.
Yep.
Saudi Arabia probably owns a comparable chunk at least. Which means that probably more than 50% of the U.S. economy is owned by overseas countries because we live in a corporate world. People, I don't think, always understand the difference between the trade deficit, which is what we've been talking about, and the budget deficit. And, Eddie, I wondered if you'd define and compare and contrast for people so they can get that bigger picture.
Okay, the trade deficit is very simple. It's the difference between the amount that we sell the world and the amount that we buy from the world. Years and years and years ago, when American goods were the best goods in the world, and everybody knew that, 50s, 60s, 70s maybe even, our trade deficit, there was no trade deficit. We always had a trade surplus. Somewhere in the 80s, when jobs and things started shifting to third world economies, not to China then, but to Malaysia, to South America, to Southeast Asia, the trade deficit started. Japan was the big one. We were buying Japanese cars, Japanese cameras, Japanese TVs. And Japan was the first country, I think, that showed up a trade deficit for us. That is to say, the goods that we were buying from Japan cost more than the goods we were selling to Japan, and we owed them money, quote unquote. The budget deficit is the difference between the amount of money that we take in through taxes and other ways the government has of accumulating money, and the amount of money that we have budgeted to be spending for things like war, for things like school lunches, for things like Medicaid and Medicare, that kind of a thing. The budget deficit is fixable. The trade deficit is much harder to fix and can have a much more difficult effect on the economy, including the jobs and the interest rates that we pay for money in this country. Have I done that?
Yeah, I think you did that. I just want people to be aware because we hear trade deficit, budget deficit, and I'm not sure people always understand. I think one of the key points that you bring up and I want people to be aware of is we don't own most of this country anymore. So this Buy America, the best country in the world, all that stuff, we're just a subsidiary of a monolithic corporate
China, Japan, England.
Who? Saudi Arabia.
Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia is mostly our oil debt to them.
Right.
But on the other hand, they own a lot of American oil companies.
And real
estate. Big chunks of, and real estate.
Boy, do they.
So and this started really with the Reagan administration. Reagan is the one that started selling this country to foreign interests.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I've got a 40-acre plot. Would you like to see it? That's a story. Another big story that's come up. I know we're running down to the end of the wire here. Merck Pharmaceuticals, along with a lot of other companies, are running into real problems. Mm-hmm. Some of the companies like Verizon and Motorola are cutting pensions. The United Auto Workers have really lost out because management drove those industries into the ground while Japan and Korea were making cars that 100,000-mile and 10-year blah, blah, blahs, and we didn't do that and kept cranking SUVs, which are now dinosaurs. So they drove it into the ground, obviously, to get rid of the unions in part and to create cheaper labor force to make the same cars that people can get from overseas. That's a whole story. But Merck got really hit with the Vioxx lawsuits, and they also have a number of patents which are beginning to expire, so they're going to have huge job losses, and they're losing a ton of money. It occurred to me they fund PRI, Public Radio International, and I wonder if that's part of their dilemma and or if that's going to cut into their funding of PRI on National Public Radio, and is that yet another one of those attacks on public radio, where just like we saw with what's his name? Carl Rove going after Bill Moyers.
Well, I'm not so sure that it's a part of the attack. What it's going to affect the amount that they give to PRI because it's going to affect their bottom line. And although that's a tax break, anything they give to PRI, anything they give to public radio comes off their taxes. If their bottom line goes away, if they start running a massive debt, they won't be able to give away money like they have. That's going to affect PRI by decreasing their operating budget,
right.
And they got to get it from somewhere else. Now, it's possible they can get it from other sources. What'll probably be the real truth will probably be they just cut back on what they can produce.
I want to remind our listeners it's 10 o'clock in the morning. You are listening to KBOO Portland, Oregon, 90.7 on the FM band. My name is Marlena Smith. It's the Electronic Salon. My guest is Eddie Goldberg. We're finishing up a conversation about culture and politics and entertainment and where they intersect. Eddie, a couple quick things. Australian youth taking to the street, not unlike the French. Do you see any cultural significance in this?
Yes, it's the same. It's basically the same kind of kids. It's disaffected youth who are basically from Muslim countries, who feel that they're not a part of the Australian family and don't have jobs and have no hope. These are the same people, in effect, that rioted in America in the 60s, people who felt disaffected from the culture and felt like they had no futures. This is going to be a big problem. Everywhere Europeans have settled and others have come in the last 25 years who haven't been brought into the culture. We do better, actually, in this country than most people do.
I heard it's also happening in the Philippines from a colleague who's recently been there. And it makes me wonder if there isn't, having seen Paradise Now and the way Muslim youth are incited by these cadres of people who have a higher level agenda, I'm wondering if we're not going to see a wave of Muslim youth all over the world who may or may not be acting independently.
Mm-hmm. H. Rapp Brown, who was a prophet, said, "There is nobody more dangerous than man who has nothing to lose."
Yeah. Finally, Eddie, 2006, any predictions?
I will certainly follow 2005. I don't make predictions because my record of predictions is pretty bad, pretty bad. All I can say is that we may finally see the wheels come off the Bush administration. That would be a nice thing. Might see the Democrats. The Democrats actually cannot win this by default. They have to have a program, and they need to have some cojones, which they have not demonstrated much of lately. We might actually see the loss of one house from the Republicans. Probably not the House of Representatives, but maybe the Senate will go back to the Democrats. I hope so anyway. But that's all I can predict. I mean, there will be a congressional election next year, and that's going to make it a very interesting year. Can I have one point of personal privilege?
Sure you can.
Fritz Richmond. I mean, I had a bunch of people I want to talk about. Bill Proxmire just died. Yeah. Eugene McCarthy, two very, very interesting Democratic politicians who were quirky mavericks and made the world a better place in most cases. Although Proxmire's Golden Fleece Awards, while funny, was often unbearably stupid about things like pure research. So I wasn't always behind those Golden Fleece Awards. But Fritz Richmond, a local guy, he moved here some years ago. He was the jug and washtub bass player for the Jim Queskin Jug Band. I first saw Fritz play 40 years ago, the Questkin Jug Band, I've seen the Rolling Stones, I've seen Bob Dylan, I've seen Jimi Hendrix, I've seen Janis Joplin. I never had more fun at a concert than I had at a Jim Questkin Jug Band concert. Mm-hmm. And a big part of it was Fritz Richmond, who reinvented the washtub bass. One of his instruments is in the Smithsonian. A wonderful man. He was on the air with us here on cable a couple of times on Retta Christie's show. He died recently a couple of weeks ago. There's a memorial service for him tomorrow. I wish I knew where it was. I'm remiss in not having brought that in. But my hat goes off to Fritz Richmond for being a wonderful man, a brilliant musician, and my heart goes out to his family and loved ones who are missing him now. I miss him, having only met him a few times.
Well, Eddie, I want to thank you personally for being one of my great guests throughout the year. Great conversations, great contribution to the community, and I wish you and your family the best in the coming year. And any quick predictions on Noodles the cat?
He's getting old, poor thing.
He's slowing down.
Looks like he might have arthritic hips, mm-hmm. and there are a lot of bigger cats moving into the neighborhood now, and he's no longer the neighborhood thug.
So now he spends more time on the lap?
Yeah.
So you predict 2006 is more of a lap cat?
I think he's in semi-retirement right now. Yeah.
No lap dancing a la the Vikings football player?
Well, he's neutered, so it wouldn't matter to him anyway.
That was a story.
Yeah.
Now we know why they didn't win.
Yes.
Okay. Hey, Eddie, thanks very much. My best to your family.
Happy holidays to everybody and to you, and I love you.
Thanks. I love you too, baby. Okay, a couple quick announcements and then a little musical break. The Winter Solstice Concert, Todd Samuelson and Linda Tomasi, post-industrial folk music, the Red and Black Cafe. That's tomorrow night at 8 p.m., Winter Solstice Concert. Indigenous Gathering to celebrate International Immigrants Day tomorrow from 4 to 7 at the SEIU Local 503 on 6401 Southeast Foster, which is Foster and Holgate. Audubon Society, if you haven't or if you need to do any more holiday shopping, don't forget to check out the Audubon Society. Birds need feeders. I was just down there this week talking about making suet balls, basically a prototype of suet balls. You just roll up some peanut butter and honey and stick some bird seeds in there, and you put it out and makes the birds really happy. And it does. I've got a lot of birds around my house. Makes the cat happy to watch them. And also the Audubon is sponsoring the Walk the Willamette River Greenway. That's tomorrow from 9 to 1. You can call them for information. And then the 106th Portland Area Christmas Bird Count will happen on December 31st from 7 a.m. to 7 p.m. This is an attempt to scientifically monitor the bird count, which is up to 55,000 participants worldwide. They need people to keep track of numbers, count birds, and to yell, "Hey, there's a bird." So you might want to do that for some kind of fun thing to do. Let's take a little break, and we'll be back with Michael Mead and some mythology. Auld Lang Syne. I really like that tune. Just gets you in a kind of a mellow end of the year mood. That from a CD titled Christmas Jazz, Jim Galloway and Jay McShane. I got some more Auld Lang Syne here that maybe I'll be able to catch up with as we go along. First, I want to let you know some of the community things going on, then I'll be right back with Michael Mead.
Tune in between 1:30 and 3 p.m. the 16th, where we'll be speaking with author, poet, and activist Luis Rodriguez about our gang youth. On Buscando America, Eduardo de Landeros Tierra and myself, Carlos Chavez. Please join us.
Okay, well, the second piece of technology didn't work, so we'll get that up later. We're going to go now to Michael Mead, and I got a nice message here from a nice woman in the community, Belle, about hearing a program last month, a tape of a man talking about ritual, wants to know the name of the tape, book, etc. Well, it's Michael Mead, M-E-A-D-E. He is a storyteller, mythologist. His tapes are available from a company called... www.mosaicvoices, M-O-S-A-I-C, voices, all one word, .org. You can check them out. They're up in Seattle, and you can get a hold of them. The one I'm working through right now is called Initiation in the Soul, the Sacred and the Profane. So I'm going to go right to that right now, and I've been doing this because we are living in mythic times, and also because the dark season is the time for telling stories and for reflecting. So I'm going to be quiet here and open up the CD, Initiation in the Soul.
A couple of poems. This is D.H. Lawrence. Not I, not I, but the wind that blows through me, a fine wind blowing the new direction of time. If only I let it bear me, carry me, if only it carries me. If only I am keen and hard like the sheer tip of a wedge driven by invisible blows, then the rock will split and we shall come at the wonder. We shall find again the Hesperides. Listen now. Who is knocking? What is that knocking? What is knocking at the door in the depth of the night? Is it someone intending to do us harm? No, no. It is the three strange angels. Admit them. Admit them. Admit them. There's something trying to come through us. And it knocks on the door in the night in the form of a dream, or it wakes us up, even in the form of a nightmare. He refers there to the angel side of it. If it doesn't come on the angel side, it comes on the demon side. It's the same stuff. If we respond, it turns out to be more angelic. If we don't, it gathers itself in a demonic form. That's the way it is. There's no choice. There's no one here to live a common life. Everybody's here to live the exactly unique life that was formed at the moment of conception and then begins to be incarnated at the moment of birth. In other words, I'm drawing a connection between the psychological work that's been done recently about what happens to the infant and how its own split, and the initiatory work that is traditional that would happen in the second infancy that occurs between childhood and adulthood. So I'm back to mentioning something about that depressive position that they call it, or the split, the 9-month birth, the second birth, first birth. 8-9 months later, this split that happens between the mother and the child. Where we're going is towards the next time that split is encountered, generally speaking, or used to be, which was called initiation. Initiation was a conscious bringing of each person into this internal wound and split in order to do some healing and in order to reveal to the person the gifts they brought. Because something's trying to come through us. But another poem in this business of myth, which, you know, I'm trying to say is also the business of the sacred, this sense of the self or the, of a deep spirit dwelling inside a person is required. And so I keep looking for ways to come at it. And, of course, Hafiz is one of the really bold people speaking directly from that place. So I'm thinking now, just trying to follow a thread in my own mind. This is called the only one. From man's perspective, in this intricate game of love, it is so easy to become confused and think you are the doer. But from God's infinite certainty, he always knows, she always knows, that he is the only one who should ever be put on trial. Really wild little idea. I'll read it again. You know, you're thinking about who gets punished for what's going on inside a person or outside in the world. And this is Hafiz's answer. From man's perspective, in this intricate game of love, he calls the whole thing the game of love. The whole thing. The pain, the joy, the loss, the presence, the absence. It's all the game of love. From man's perspective, in this intricate game of love, it's so easy to become confused and think we each are the doer. But from God's infinite certainty, he or she always knows that he is the only one who should ever be put on trial. In the depths of the real struggle for the presence of the self, the idea is that God is actually entering trial of the world again and again. It's an essential idea if forgiveness is going to be approached. One of the reasons it's so hard for any of us to change is because it's so hard for us to forgive ourselves for what we were doing before we realized we had to change. This kind of deep internal self-forgiveness that says, for whatever the reasons were, I acted that way, and now I realize I have to act another way, or I'm dying, or what's called entering the fate worse than death. And there's a required forgiveness for oneself for having acted a certain way. And Hafiz goes right to it and says, put God on trial, because really it was his idea or her idea. He doesn't care which one you're talking about. So a few more things about it. It's kind of like warming up to go after initiatory ideas. I want to mention Blake again. Each person has an image into which everything they know fits, into which everything they don't know could fit. This is the bold, poetic thought. The image that we came here to live out can carry everything, not just what we know, but everything we don't know. When this sense of the internal imagination awakens, people who can't add can multiply. I mean, even mathematics fits. Everything fits because the self has this tremendous scope. When the world doesn't make sense, what's lacking when there's not a story that coheres everybody, what's lacking when people just can't figure out how to let go and stop increasing the pain, what's lacking is imagination. Imagination is the power of being human. That which is so denied in the world, what I was talking about earlier, as the capacity to see things that are not there, you know, to see things that are not there, is called imagination. To be in touch with that which is betwixt and between is the core gesture of being human, near as I can tell. Imagination is needed to free oneself from the entanglements of fate and from early deterministic traumas. Just a simple sentence, but it has two things in it. The fate we talked about, those, the web that attached to us when we were born, and then those deterministic traumas we went through in our infancy and childhood. The deterministic traumas. Everybody carries them. Most people call it success to get to act them out on others. You know what I'm saying? To be successful now is to wage one's traumas on someone else. That's what we're watching on the world stage now. That's called success. Turning attention to the core imagination of the self causes the archetypal, mythic, if you wish, forces to aid rather than thwart growth. Imagination is the natural power of the self, the mythic key that unlocks the destiny rooted in one's fate. Fate is what holds us necessarily. Destiny is what can unlock that fate to something greater than we start out even being aware of. And imagination is the key. To imagine, and imagine, how do I say that? Imagine doesn't mean you have an imaginary, right, which means it's not real. And then you have an imaginal, which means it's more real than real. The imaginal combines the concrete with the unseen. But where I want to get to is this. The self, the deep self, is the repository of knowledge. Exactly the knowledge that the ego requires, whether it knows it or not. What the ego needs to, what it's hungering for, what the person or personality is hungering for, exists already in the deep self. That's the setup. Learning isn't encountering something completely new. It's encountering what already exists inside that we couldn't get to until we saw it a little bit outside. You get what I'm saying? We're always trying to relearn what we entered the world trying to demonstrate. The knowledge in the self is wisdom, not abstract or overly intellectual, but the embodied wisdom that has value in this time and place. Near as I know, wisdom has two roots. One root of wisdom is close to direction and guidance, a capacity for knowing the direction and giving guidance. The other root goes to the word lyrical. Wisdom is a song. It's a lyric that's already pronounced inside one's soul. Life is the living out and struggling through the circumstances until the internal lyric becomes conscious. And then a person is able to offer direction and guidance in a genuine way. Wisdom, like lots of things, has been abstracted to be something intellectual or something like that. Wisdom is always an embodied experience. And what was wise 100 years ago can be very foolish now. Wisdom is timely. So the idea isn't to find wisdom in some other place. The idea is to find things, whether it's from the past or from the present, that can break the inner lyric into conscious wisdom. Wisdom is usually the province of the elders. The interesting thing is the elder is what is born in the youth initiation. I've studied initiation from tribal orientations from all over the world and at different times, through books mostly, but through conversations and experiments. And near as I can figure out what happens in the initiation of youth, it is the birth of the elder in the person. That what is born, they already are a youth, so they don't have to have a youth born. So what gets born is the elder to be. It's why young people can be so wise. The elder, when it's a living expression, not a kind of position. The elder is the awakened self, the self having a way of acting in the world. Wisdom is the imaginative power of the self, sometimes called Sophia, also called the wisdom of God, the feminine form of God. Revelation and redemption are necessary to any true opus. In other words, one of the games right now is that some people are blessed by revelation and other people are just supposed to work until they die. But the real idea is that revelation and redemption of aspects of oneself are the natural human inheritance and part of the project of any self experiment. I'm trying to redeem salvation and take it back from the salvationists who are trying to, you know what I'm saying, by claiming they have the word, are trying to take away other people's opportunity to encounter their own salvation, which is a much smaller thing than what it's made out to be. It happens on a personal level. The self must be revealed to oneself, and aspects of the soul must be redeemed for real work to continue. One of the problems with the born-again idea is that the person born again doesn't keep being born again. You know what I'm saying?
They forget it's not that you were born again, it's that you're supposed to keep being born again and therefore lose the dogmatic aspect of it. You get what I'm saying? Once a person gets on the path of initiating and opening the inner life, it is a path, and initiate means to take the first step, and you're supposed to keep taking the first step and keep moving the path by taking it. And so the two things would be going on during youth initiation: the revelation of the deep self to the person who is that self or carrying that self, and the healing of whatever might have gone wrong in the first birth. Initiatory ritual becomes the temple or the holding space for this kind of rebirth to occur, but also gives the opportunity to heal what didn't happen in the holding environment of the infant. If being born in the modern world, where, amongst other things, many mothers weren't mothered, right? The dissociation that occurs between the profane and the sacred causes the split between the mind and the body. Since women give birth, carry the actual cells and living intensity of other beings in themselves, when this split starts to occur, women are pushed further away. You get what I'm saying? Because they embody so much of life. And so what happens then, the mother, feeling uneasy in her own body and in her own relationship to the self, cannot empathically contain the child. And so now something really serious has occurred, called anxiety, if you want to call it that. Then comes the next period when something is supposed to happen, which is youth initiation, when the whole tribe considers, who is this little being and what are we going to do to help them live out the project of the self and become a gift to the tribe? When that doesn't happen, then you have this double wound. The infant that wasn't held, the youth that wasn't revealed. And now, and then you have a bunch of adults walking around with anxiety levels that are just, you know, unnatural, you know, or unbelievable, or uncontainable. And so then you have increasing addiction, increasing violence, and so on, which a lot of which has to do with an inability to hold the tension and the anxiety that starts all the way back in infancy and then is multiplied through youth. We have to look back at this whole collapse of the imaginative core of culture. The first imagination being that this child coming in is a gift of the eternal, and that this woman has carried it and delivered it and now will match it empathically and bless it, to borrow the word, so that that little being gets to live its life out. That fails, and then the second one fails, where the whole tribe becomes the mother and comes and say, we're all going to hold you now until you're born again as a deeper version of your own self. And when that one collapses, you now have people like almost just randomly in great anxiety stumbling about. So what we're doing now by saying that we're looking at mythic territory, trying to heal the split between nature and culture, these are big things, and between the individual and the group, as well as between the history and the eternal. This is absolutely necessary and a totally reckless endeavor. I mean, reckless beyond psychology, reckless beyond cultural agreements. It's the radical attempt to refind a mythic and therefore a spiritual life, despite the fact that the templates and forms are mostly broken and mostly empty. I mean, that's what I think that we're attempting to do, not just us sitting here, but everybody trying to go back and learn tribal ways, and everybody trying to do spiritual practices. It's an attempt to re-cohere the world. It's an attempt to end the great separation, which includes nature and culture, but also is the falling out of cosmology. The falling away from a cosmological sense of belonging. So, I mean, if we fail, okay, because the attempt is really large. You get what I'm saying? The perfectionism has no place in it, because it's just too great of an undertaking, and it's too fraught with failure. And so the idea is just to make glorious mistakes. The idea is to get into the right trouble. The idea is to not just feel pain, but to suffer it fully. That kind of thing, you know. Yeah, and notice that whatever, take the addiction. When people talk about it, one time when they're talking about it, they're talking about self-medicating. Ah, medicine is involved. It's an attempt to heal. And another time they're talking about it as getting high. Oh, it's an attempt to be spiritual. What's both? And what is it? What does it turn out to be? Replacing spiritual presence with a substance. It's abusing the substance because the way to the spirit can't be found. All addicted people are spiritual, no question. And on an individual level, what's happening is death and rebirth. And the problem is always spiritual. This is a major aspect of modern human experience, is to be disoriented most of one's life and then be disoriented on the way to death, which is where all life is going. The two great orientations are what most people do not experience. What is this life about? And how do I meet death in a way that confirms the meaning of the life I lived? The result is we don't die enough, and real change doesn't occur. Death is really means change. Death is something dies and something else lives. There's never total death. Death is the loss of one form while life itself pours into another form. And the idea, the very core idea in initiation, is to die in order to grow, to die in order to live a bigger life. The hardest thing to do now, and one reason I'm talking about the inoculation of mythology and so on, is to have a big life, a big in the sense of full, especially inner life, while the outer collapse is crushing most things and many people. The idea that there are holy hills somewhere and that someone in those hills has the gifts that are ours.
I have to go back one because we missed the great story that I want you to hear. Let's see if that's up now.
We've all died a number of times. That's how we got here. And after a while, you start to look forward to it, almost. And there's a lot of stories written about it, or not written. They were originally told, and then they got written. So this is an initiation story from Guatemala, southern Mexico as well. Belize, maybe, too. Once upon a time, or once, before time became so locked in the linear march to the edge of the world, once, when time was only the counting of the hours of the day, once, when everyone still knew that the edge of the day was the beginning of eternity and that night was the return of the endless world, once, in the time before time got trapped in time. Once upon that time, there was a village. And it happened that in a village a child was born. And it happened that the child being born was a boy. And it happened that for various circumstances, too lengthy and complicated and intricate to go in now, into now, the child was called Poder. That is to say, the child was given the name Poder, which means gift, which means luck, which means blessing, which means chance, which means power, which means skill, which means faith, which means luck. The child that was born was called by all of those names, but to save time, it was condensed into the phrase Poder. And it happened that when this child was born and incarnating into the world, it happened that the midwife, because her eyes were trained to really see what was there and what was not there, it happened that the midwife noticed that the child was born with a green cloak on its back, and it was holding in its hand a little gourd, and in the gourd there was enough water to almost fill it.
when it happened that the midwife, who is trained in these matters, saw those gifts coming into the world with that little child, Poder. It also happened because she knew her job. She took the cake, and she took the little gourd full of water, and she put them to the side until they could be used again later. And it happened because this was in the old time, in the old days, before all of these things got forgotten and got broken down into little pieces that people can hardly find anymore. It happened that because things were still intact at that time, the midwife told the mother of the gifts that came into the world with the child that she gave birth to. For the mother was too busy in the labors of birth to notice what was happening beyond what she was involved in. And it happened that the midwife also told certain members of the family that were often called the godparents, the parents that were there to make sure that the god part of the child was grown, told them about the green cloak and about the little gourd with the water in it. And then, after 8 days had passed, on the eighth day, when the family was doing those rituals that you do in order to encourage and preserve the life of the new one who has been just been born, the midwife took those gifts and took them way out into the hills and gave them out there to a holy person to keep until they could be looked for, sought after, and hopefully used later. And then everyone went back to living the way people live in the village, even after a special child has been born. Because of the care of the mother of the child, because of the attention of the godparents, because of the interest of other members of the family and the village, that little Poder grew pretty well. Pretty soon, Poder was running about, acting like a regular child, enjoying the various things, and getting hurt in the way that people usually are. And time went by, and eventually, Poder came to that strange place called youth, that separation place between childhood and being an adult. And then Poder began to go around asking, well, what am I here for anyway? Am I here to give something to the world, and does the world have something to give to me? And at that point, people realized that the childhood of Poder was over, and it was time for Poder to go out into the world and find out how his relationship to the world would go. And so the only thing he was told, and he was told it by the midwife who had been there looking with both of her eyes on the occasion of his birth, the only thing he was told was that out in the world somewhere, there was someone that had gifts that belonged to him. And having gathered that knowledge, Poder left the village and began to wander. And he wandered out and happened to go into the hills out beyond the village. And it happened for reasons that no one can explain to this day that Poder came upon the holy person out there in the hills who had, in fact, the little green cloak and the little gourd mostly filled with water that had been born as the gifts from the other world entering into this world at the moment when Poder was born. And so a ceremony was made there, and a ritual as well. And in the course of those things, the gifts were given by the holy person back to Poder. That is to say, Poder received back the green cloak he had been born with, and the little gourd mostly filled with water. And upon receiving them, he was giving information and instruction regarding the use of these gifts. Poder was told that those who are born with the green cloak have a responsibility to the green world. And those who are born with a gourd with water in it are born to be rainmakers in this world. That is to say, since this was a hot and arid place, Poder had entered this world with the gifts of bringing water to dry places, with the gift of bringing rain to the places where people struggled to grow corn and beans and squash. That is to say, Poder was given the information and the instruction so that he could be a helper in the lives of people and so that he could contribute to the growing abundance of the world. Poder became a rainmaker, and Poder became one who takes responsibility for the green things of the world. After that, having gotten the proper instruction, Hodea went back to the village where he belonged, where he began, and he began to practice the craft of making rain. At the same time, it happened that there was another child in the village who had grown to the age of adolescence or youth, and it happened that that one was not sent out after gifts and was not told for whatever reason about gifts that came into the world with that person. And it happened that that one, hungry to be in touch with gifts, followed someone who was looking for their gifts. And it happened that that person that was followed was also a rainmaker. And it happened that the one who was not told about their gifts claimed the rainmaking gifts of the other person. And then it happened that that one, instructed on how to make rain, was actually carrying gifts intended for someone else and was empty with regard to their own gifts. And it happened that this one, who learned the ways of making rain improperly, that one began to make rain. And not knowing the nature of the gift and not having the innate and natural skill for using this water-producing property properly, that one, who had in fact stolen the gift, caused such a great storm of clouds to form in the sky, caused such a great torrential downpour of rain that everything began to be drowned and everything began to be covered with a great flood of rain that no one could stop. And pretty soon the small plants were being washed out of their roots and floating along. The rivers were swelling to the point where they gushed into the villages and began to swamp the houses and obliterate the villages and drown the people. People began to pray not for rain, but that rain would stop. In that arid place, people began to pray that rain would stop altogether. And pretty soon, God, who had turned a deaf ear on the people because of this misuse of gifts, agreed to stop the rain. And when the rain stopped and things began to dry out again, God spoke to the people and said, because of this misappropriation of gifts, because of this theft of skills, from now on, people will be born with gifts, but their sight will be occluded. And from now on, when people are born, they will not know what gifts are theirs. No one will be there to see and spot their gifts, and no one will be there to take those gifts and preserve them in holy places until it is time to find them. That's what this story says. That's what the old people say about this business of being gifted and being not gifted, about this business of helping the world and hurting it, about this business of having luck and having bad luck. And the old people also say, we, those of us who are born at this time, those of us who have entered the world since that great torrential downpour and flood, are the children of those who were gifted and those who have stolen gifts. At least, that's what the old people say about this story. That's what they say about this life. And tell me this, if they don't know, who does? So, Poder. It's one of those stories that has a lot of information besides the story, and it tells you right up front that Poder means gift, skill, luck, chance, fate. It's the part of a person that's given. And it has to be found again. The idea that there are holy hills somewhere and that someone in those hills has the gifts that are ours, that we were born with but couldn't carry, because the beginning of carrying is carrying the regular communal human stuff. And until this kind of spiritual longing occurs, a person really can't carry their gifts. Although, strangely enough, there's usually at least one occasion during childhood when they do manifest anyway. But the part that I want to focus on, the initiated soul, the soul lives by longing.
And the longing, the first big longing in the philosophical terms goes something like, where did I come from? Who am I? What am I here to do? Those are the three basic philosophical questions that people have figured out over the years. But in the more tribal, initiatory, and imaginal way of going at it, it's the longing for gifts that already exist, but that we can't get our hands on fully until we have some radical experience which cracks open the common sense of self. Call it the ego, call it narcissism, if you will, the bubble that a person grows up in. And so in that is the drive for initiation. And so what I want to do is briefly describe the basic core idea of it. So the basic idea that you can find in anthropology, but also in a lot of tribal lore, is three steps. That anything that's initiatory has three steps in it. The first is separation. And just to focus for a minute on youth initiation, because it's often the beginning of the initiatory road of that person. Youth is the expected time when initiation will begin. Certain initiations happen on the basis of expectation. The youthful one, some people consider marriage or serious relationship to be another initiatory step. And then there's the expected initiation when a person goes from being an adult to an elder. And then the last initiation is considered to be death, when a person leaves the road of this life and enters the road on the other side. Those are the expected ones. Then there's the unexpected ones, the ones that happen at any given time for all kinds of reasons, accidental and intentional. So just to take the classic first one, is usually considered to be the youth initiation, because the circumstances around children are different. The first step is separation. For some reason, a person is separated from everyone, more or less, and everything that they know. Since it is not done formally very much anymore, you get what someone once called informal initiation. The idea here is that the human soul is looking to be initiated deeply into its own life. And if the culture forgets to do it, the soul still looks for it anyway, and it will take any significant occurrence that shows a break or a separation from regular life, and it will take that on as initiatory. And so when there's no formal initiation, you'll find illness, getting thrown out of something, getting a nervous or mental breakdown, loss of a loved one, which separates one from someone that was loved, and it also brings the entry of death. For young women now, an abortion is a straight-up initiatory, actually underworld initiation. It's initiation to the death mother rather than the birth mother. It's an initiation to the midwife at the end of life rather than the midwife at birth. You get what I'm saying? Let's see, what would the other possibility is? Falling into addiction, various things like that. Wherever there's a separation and a person no longer can be as they were with the family and with their friends. Does that make some sense? I have several of them. But the one that's indelible to me is when I had to make this decision about whether to go into the military during Vietnam. I'd already gone through some experiences of separation, but that was a dramatic one. And one that sticks with me because in the course of it, I wound up in a military prison. And I have never left that place in the sense that I carry it with me. It is. So here's a way to understand it. Initiatory experiences are such that if we took it away from you, you would disappear. It is so indelibly marked into oneself that if it was taken away from you, you would also go. In tribal initiations, people often get body markings, scarification, scars, in order to make clear what has happened and in order to leave a physical record of a spiritual experience. Some people have those, the scar of the accident that broke them into pieces and so on and so forth. Others have a psychic scar. But the initiatory experiences are deep enough that they have become part of oneself and life, and if it was taken away, you would also go. So what happens is this separation, the function of it and the effect of it, is we wander into the holy hills where we're supposed to go. So the reason to go back and find it, and now I have to tell you that a lot of people, a lot of us trick ourselves that we didn't have it. My understanding, I've never met anyone 22 years or older that didn't have an initiatory experience. Because what happens is we either have it and somehow can go back and uncover it, or else we die. I have friends that didn't make it through youth. They died. That was their initiation, in a sense. They got initiated to the other world. The rest of us got initiated to this world. But in the ignorance of the culture, in the loss of memory about what the course of this road of life and death is, these things get covered up. But they're terribly significant because the experience of the separation leads into the ordeal. That's the second step. Separation, second step is ordeal. And in the ordeal, we begin to encounter those things that are both the wounds in our lives and the gifts. Now, here's the thing. I'm trying to say that I've never met anyone 22 or older who is not initiated to the realm of their own soul. That doesn't mean that we're all great and everything's worked out. It just means that we have stumbled somehow in the right direction, usually pushed by pain. Pushed by pain. See, the thing that we're initiated to is what we can stand, that other people cannot stand. And we constantly have to make another stand in this ground where other people would refuse to go. And just to say another thing, an old saying about initiation, they say that initiation took me further than I would ever choose to go. The areas that we go into are deeper and beyond our regular capacity to understand or tolerate pain, confusion, even beauty. And so that's why it becomes this indelible marking of the soul. And those who are struggling with similar things can see. The trouble is then you wind up there again and again. The one that we're starting to feel, the separation has enough tear in it, but the second step is ordeal. I'm separate from everybody and I'm running. I'm suicidal. I'm going up and down the coast. I'm in and out of drugs. I'm in and out of violence. That's the ordeal part. Can I find myself in this chaos? Can I find myself in this emotional breakdown? Can I find myself in this imprisonment? Can I find myself in this illness? Can I find myself in this incredible loss where everything is going? I feel like everything is disappearing from me. Can I find myself in there? Because in the midst of it, that's what's found, is one's self. Or, to put it another way, that invisible thing that carries us even when we don't know we're being carried. That's the gift. That's the real deep gift. That's something that carries us across the abysses and through, you know, the burning grounds and through the terrors and the confusions. So the second stage is the terror, the confusion, the pain, the obstacle, and it's often referred to as the ordeal, the ordeals. It's not just that someone leaves me, but I have to wallow for 6 months and then begin to learn the steps as if I'm walking all over again. But now I have to walk on the territory where I'm supposed to be, in the woods, in the forest, in the green places. Or now I have to walk where I'm supposed to be, in the terrifying nights, in the places where people do lose their minds, do lose their lives. I have to learn to walk there. Remembering that the midwife is dealing with life and death. Right? She is significant at the beginning of the story because she's showing that the whole thing is about life and death. And every initiatory thing is an initiation to both life and death. A small death occurs in every initiation. As a matter of fact, the word separation is a little bit of a cover-up word for something has died. There's always beauty in this stuff, even the terrible stuff, and the significant details, the way that the psyche, the self, the soul wants to work this out. And what I'm trying to say is the symbolic language and world of mythology is not only nearby, it's also intelligible and can be understood as soon as we remove the obstacles that are daily life obstacles. And also to say that young people are desperately seeking, they're wandering in the holy hills no matter where they are, because they're looking for the accoutrements and elements of their soul or self journey. So the second one is the ordeals, and in the ordeals, certain signs, symbols, and things will occur, and they are not accidental. They are tied directly to the threads of the self. This is a relationship between the deep self and the world. And what happens is significant beyond calculation. And just to put the third step in, because I didn't want to leave in the in-between world there, and I wanted to amplify what's happening when the person comes and acts out the role of the wise elder, saying, look, I know that you've been pulled back into the ordeal, then these are a lot of blows and a lot of the underworld hitting. But remember, this is your skill, this is your luck, this is your poder.
Okay, that's Michael Mead, mythologist. Just some amazing stuff. We're going to continue that in the new year, in January 06. I'll be back the second and third Fridays. That was, of course, Initiation in the Soul, the Sacred and the Profane. Michael Mead, M-E-A-D-E, storyteller, mythologist. Stories are good, of course, for this dark season. And you can find that on the web at mosaicvoices.org. That's M-O-S-A-I-C, voices, one word, .org. And to Michelle, I'll have to call you, Michelle. I know it's Hafiz, H-A-F-I-Z, but when I'm listening to this stuff, I'm not in my left brain, so I'm not really focused on the details. I'm kind of caught up in the whole thing of it. I want to thank you all for listening today. It's 4 minutes before the hour of 11. You are listening to KBOO Portland, Oregon, 90.7 on the FM band in Portland, your community radio station. Blessings to all of you. It's the dark season. Hang on to each other. Stay warm. Drink lots of soup, lots of clear water. Wash your hands. Be friendly with people. No double dipping. If your hands aren't clean, don't be dipping into those dishes at all the holiday parties. Let's see what else. That's my mom advice. And now I think I'm going to go to an interesting version of Auld Lang Syne. Dean Shostak, Crystal Carols, playing a harmonium invented by Benjamin Franklin in 1761. Tuned glass bowls mounted on a spindle. Glasses are spun by a flywheel connected to foot treadle, and the music is played by moistened fingers rubbing on the glass. Here we go. We'll be right back.